You're listening to Blue Yonder with your hosts, Jim Jones, Peter Streets, and introducing Aaron Hubbard.
Everybody, welcome to episode 70 of Blue Yonder. I'm Jim Jones.
And I'm Aaron Hubbard.
And we are going to ditch the formalities this week because we have a very special guest with us, Ian Samuel.
The long-awaited interview.
Very special.
Very special, absolutely.
I feel pretty special.
You should, you should. You're here on our show. We've only done this twice. We did Steve Jackson and now you. But we are going to basically be talking to you all about all sorts of law stuff. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell the audience a little bit about you.
Sure, sure. Well, I'm an attorney. I live in Washington, D.C., where I have lived for about 2 years. I have known your co-host since I was just a kid, basically. Long time, at least,
We're all
15 years
then.
Or something? Long time. In addition to being all of that stuff, I'm also the world's biggest nerd. So, that's basically the deal.
Great. Now, I hear you have a disclaimer that you want to drop on us up front.
I guess. I mean, I don't know why people even have to say this anymore, but like every person with a job is aware, I'm an attorney for the government. I work for the Justice Department, but no one at the Justice Department even has any opinions on any of the stuff that I'm about to espouse. And if they did, I certainly wouldn't be expressing them. So the point is, I'm speaking for myself. But I have to say that I think everything I'm going to say is so persuasive and obviously correct that it should be the position of the government.
Of course, I would expect nothing less.
So the point is, if they haven't said it yet, just keep waiting. It'll be their official position soon.
Gotcha. So you are, in fact, a lawyer, but this is not legal advice.
Right. It's not legal. There's no listening to this show does not create an attorney-client relationship. You have to give me money for that.
All right, cool. So with that out of the way, we've got a couple of things like on the personal, and then we're going to head on to the professional. But one thing I've always been struck by you say that you're the world's largest nerd, biggest nerd.
Yep.
And I kind of agree. I mean, you've got a lot of nerd credentials there. But I would say that you're also pretty high amongst the functional geeks that I know. In fact, if I took two axes, one functional and one geek, I say you're probably the single person I know with the combined highest ratings on both said axes.
Well, thank you.
I mean, you're confident, successful. I've seen you be good with the ladies. I've heard you talk about it for many years, but in the last couple of years when we've been traveling together, I've seen this with my own two eyes. And again, your nerd credentials. We met on a internet use group, arguing Star Trek versus Star Wars, which is better.
That's pretty nerdy.
Yeah.
What's still kind
not
of
which is better? You're making it sound better than it is. Which would be militarily superior in a hypothetical all Federation versus all Empire conflict? Better would be like a sort of interesting aesthetic debate. But this was more, let's measure the lengths of the beams on the screen and get turbo laser wattage ratings, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and when I say we were like this was a hobby, I mean this wasn't something like we got to digest once a month. We were in the trenches fighting every fucking day.
Every day. I went back and checked a while ago to measure the number of posts I had on that news group, and it was around 10,000. 10,000 posts.
Wow.
A lot of them were long, too. I mean, this was a huge, huge investment of my early teenage years.
And I have to say, I regret nothing.
I regret nothing. I learned a lot. I genuinely learned a great deal about the scientific mode of inquiry from that stuff. So it was great.
So what is the wattage of a turbo laser?
I used to know.
Well,
this.
It's high. It's really high. Apparently, these things are. Wouldn't be watts. It would be joules, I guess. But apparently, these things. They can vaporize an asteroid. I don't know if you've ever seen The Empire Strikes Back.
I haven't. That's the one movie that I've been really wanting to get to, but I just haven't had time.
It's in your Netflix queue.
Yeah.
You're going to really enjoy it. Don't let anyone spoil the ending.
Okay.
So anyway, what do you owe this dichotomy to? Because that they don't roll many of yourself off the assembly line. That's like not, you know, they're not pumping them out day after day at Chrysler in Japan.
Good rolls on his character stats. That's my guess.
Yeah, I think mainly it's that I roll 20s. I mean, what can I say? But, it, you know, I don't really know. I mean, I have to say I don't feel especially functional a lot of the time. And, you know, if I am, I guess I just sort of it's partly that. You know, a lot of geeks are younger guys who haven't really grown into themselves yet and haven't found the sort of confidence that can come from, like, understanding that all the stuff that makes you different and strange is also going to be a source of being really great at stuff. And once you get into your life a little more, I mean, as I see, you know, guys and girls sort of grow up and grow into themselves, they all end up, I think, being pretty highly functional. I mean, we can all think of the sort of counterexamples of the guy who's 35 and still lives with his mom. But I think, you know, 99% of cases, pretty much, you know, geeks end up running the world. I mean, it's just, you know, richest guys in the world are huge nerds. They seem pretty highly functional. So I think it's just a thing that, you know, you got to get through, you know, when you're 13 or 14 and it sort of sucks for a while. But then you realize that, you know, you're actually destined for greatness.
Cool. Speaking of being functional and, like, you know, multidisciplinary and multi-interest, you talk about, you talk more than most geeks anyway about sports related topics.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if the Broncos are doing well, cause you're a Colorado native, you're all talking shit on Twitter and sending people emails. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm. when the, baseball teams, the Colorado Rockies had that playoff run, you were all about that. But I also noticed you're a little bit, maybe, a front runner, hometown front runner. Like when you're mm-hmm. in New York, you're all about the, you know, New York Giants, and you're always kind of follow the Colorado sports teams. But, you know, I don't know if you're into the Washington Wizards now or the.
Well, no, but yeah, no, I like to pay attention to the people locally. You know, they care about the local team, so it's, you know, it's nice to care.
Right.
You have something to talk about.
Are you actually diehard for lots of sports, or do you just kind of follow when the home teams are doing well, or is it like a political career ploy or what?
Well, you know, I think it's, I guess I do, I guess I mean, I classified fairly as a pretty big sports fan, and I sort of enjoy the nerd aspects of it. It's why I've come to appreciate baseball a lot, because it has the best statistics. And, you know, it's a lot of fun. I mean, essentially it's not all that different from, you know, there was an XKCD comic, I don't know, about 2 weeks ago that said, it was like two guys talking, and one of them said to the other, hey, so, weighted random number generator just produced a new set of outputs. Let's yeah. put narratives from them.
Right.
And the bottom was captioned all sports commentary.
Yep.
And that's basically right. But then the alt text of the comic was, you know, and for that matter, Dungeons and Dragons, which is also true.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think of this as a very, you know, as you get into it, you know, sports fandom becomes very, very nerdy. And that's what I like about it. I really enjoy, you know, fantasy baseball and the sort of, that side of it. So I'm a big fan.
See, I'm actually afraid of fantasy baseball, because you're right. Like, I think baseball is the only game where if you look at the stat box, you basically can visualize exactly how the game went down. I mean,
yeah,
every play, every interaction. It's not like football where there's so many things going on in the field that if you just look at the score box and, you know, the running play commentary, whatever, you don't know everything that's going on. But baseball is pure math. It could be yeah. represented as just a set of numbers. And, yeah. you know, I'm big time into fantasy football, fantasy baseball, since it lasts, like, basically, I think a season's 3.5 years long, and it has, like, 7,000
yeah,
games.
It's a standard 3.5-er is what we call it, 3.5-er.
Yeah, and there's
– the standard 3.5-year season.
There's at least 5 games every day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would, like, lose job and family for me.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's one of these things where you can go as deep as you want to go. You can really, really get into this stuff at a level, because there's also so much happening. I mean, you know, there's a lot of baseball players in the world, and they're constantly doing things or being picked up out of the minor leagues. And,
God.
I mean, you know, I know people who have, you know, National League-only AAA fantasy leagues.
Right.
And, you know, they love it.
Yeah, I know that too.
But the rabbit hole is deep, very deep.
Moving back to the nerd side of the spectrum.
Speaking of a deep rabbit hole.
We talked about in the intro about Star Wars versus Star Trek as a hobby, and I've thought about this a lot. Because did that in some way, because you were very much into debate throughout high school and college. I think you won some championships, if I recall correctly.
I was a national debate champion. Now that is nerdy.
That is white and nerdy. Do you think that getting into that, you know, argumentative and, you know, very cutthroat and, you know, adversarial environment, Star Wars versus Star Trek, did that inspire you to debate and a legal career, or was it the other way around? Because I think that too. Was I attracted to that because, you know, Star Wars versus Star Trek? And then I became a cross-grained asshole that argues all the time and wants to be right because of that participation? Or was I a cross-grained asshole that wanted to be right all the time and I was attracted to the Star Wars versus Star Trek debate? Where do you think you lie on that?
I think, to some extent, it's sort of mutually reinforcing, right? Mm. I mean, I wouldn't have gotten into that stuff if I didn't sort of enjoy arguing about, I mean, you know, the idea of arguing about, you know, the military capabilities of two entirely fictional armies is you have to enjoy arguing a little bit to start with and have the right kind of personality.
Right.
But it definitely did. I mean, you know, it was a lot of fun. And it was the first time I'd ever had sort of reasonably structured, because the thing about a news group post is, you know, you can be as precise and as structured as you want in your replies to people. So unlike an argument in person where it's just sort of this constant back and forth flow and, you know, you don't really get to get all your points out before the other person wants to talk and things can go off in other directions, you know, in a written argument, and this is the first time I'd ever really had a written argument, you can really, you know, you have some kind of structured disagreement and really get into that. And that actually ends up being pretty important both in the world of debate and then in the world of law because, you know, debate isn't written, but it is highly structured, and arguments in, you know, legal briefing are obviously both written and structured. So, yeah, I think it's mutually reinforcing. I am kind of a pisser. There's no doubt about that. And I do enjoy, you know, I was giving my mom hell about, you know, all sorts of stuff my entire life. But I think it definitely, you know, it did play a role for sure. And for that, I will always be very glad.
We played that like an MMO. I mean, I would say that our generation destroyed the group. Because
I think that's right.
We took that over and mind fucked the group. I mean, we established like parliamentary law and Robert's Rules of Orders.
Wait,
and
what? Oh, explain this to me. Parliamentary law.
There was a government. There was a government of the news.
Wait.
And there were elections. There were written, like, extensive written rules, which were actually, you know, they were, I mean, you might ask how those got enforced, but it's just everyone sort of, I mean, it was consent of the governed, basically. Everyone just believed in them.
Yeah.
And when you didn't, you know, you sort of had to, you know, you had to overcome the weight of opinion to the contrary.
We are still here talking about Star Wars versus Star Trek, right?
Yeah. This blows my mind. This went deep. And we basically hung the Trek fans with the rope they gave us. Like, the whole time, they went along with all these things we were putting in place that was designed to destroy, invalidate, and negate every possible avenue of argument they could make.
Right. I mean, what happened was, I mean, as it became more serious and more structured, and I mean, this debate has been going on forever, but for whatever reason, it started to attract the attention of two kinds of people. One, people who were actually like engineers and scientists, and so could bring to bear sort of actual technical expertise on how for example, how much energy would it take to blow up a planet? Well, that's a question that sounds in science, and there's an answer to that, right? And you can figure out what it is to a, you know, reasonably good degree of precision, and infer other stuff. And then we had a group of people who, you know, were like, you know, were like me, who didn't have, you know, sort of any particular knowledge, but had a lot of free time and a lot of enthusiasm for the argument. And then over time, as it turns out, you know, this sort of worked itself out such that the debate basically ended. I just don't think that there's any sort of like on a sort of the playing field that was established with the sort of assumptions about, you know, you can't say things like the good guys always win and things like that. On the playing field that was established, it just became clear after long enough that there was like an answer to this question and there was no point debating it anymore.
Well, I think we've opened the topic back up here on Blue Yonder because Aaron and I have a segment where I try to disprove Star Wars' superiority.
What do you got?
Well, I went with time travel, first of all. I decided that Well, okay, Star Wars, they can pick, the Empire can pick the place that it's fought because they have speed on their side, but Star Trek has more canonical examples of time travel. So I think Star Trek should be able to pick the time that they fight in.
That'd be fine, except there are no examples of the Federation using time travel to win a military conflict. I mean, why don't they just do that to the Borg anyway?
Isn't that like exactly what I said?
That's basically, well, you didn't add the military. You said they didn't use it to change, I guess, the future or the past.
Right.
Success, but then they brought the whale back, and we were like, oh, well, where does that stand?
You know? Yeah. They have changed. But the other thing is,
In Enterprise, I would argue, which is, however bad, canonical, they do use time travel to alter the future militarily.
The other thing that I would say is that they can displace, time, but they can't really do that to space. Because you never see them go back in time and also travel to another galaxy.
So are you saying that they could not go back in time far enough to then travel to where they needed to be to kill?
Not unless they had like a generation ship. I mean, you saw how long it took Voyager to get from the freaking...
Well, isn't the Enterprise essentially a generation ship? With Wesley Crusher, I think you could pull off generations on that ship.
I don't know. By the time they got to the Star Wars galaxy, they might all be insane or want to just join up. Are we really doing this? Are we debating okay, this on the
yeah,
show?
Yeah, well, let's not debate it here.
I did want to say that the other thing I was awful proud of is that... because, we had troll groups and whatnot back in the day, and they prided themselves on destroying news groups. Like, they would alter the signal-to-noise ratio so high that the group would... Everyone would leave, and for, a couple weeks, if you could disrupt traffic for a couple weeks, a lot of times the groups are fragile enough that they'd never reform. One of the things I was always proud of the group is that we usually... we defeated these trolls, and we actually co-opted them several times. Like,
Yeah, we did.
There was one group called the Adjective Army, and there was another one that did the meow meow stuff. And they were like kind of like feared opponents of the internet. And we just like, okay, this is as fun as what we were doing last week. So come on, bring it.
In many ways, I mean, it's like you can't get more annoying than a bunch of people who want to argue the technical details about a military conflict between Star Trek and Star Wars. Like,
right.
It's like just by showing up, we're sort of trolling you. I mean, what do you, it's like, you think the meow meow stuff's annoying? Like, well, we're doing something by choice that's even probably a lot more tedious and worse.
That's like showing up at Rick Astley's house and expecting to troll him.
Yeah, right. We're going to Rickroll you, dude.
Exactly.
Wrong.
Sorry, this is how I live.
Yeah. So I actually met you for the first time at PAX in 2010, PAX East, rather, where this was your first PAX, correct?
It was my first PAX, and it was the first PAX East.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And believe it or not, I don't know what the odds are against this. You could probably figure them out with your math expertise. But you were selected to be an Omega Knot on your first try.
Yes, I was. And the weird thing is, I kind of had a feeling that I was going to be. I mean, I can't prove this, obviously, and hindsight bias and whatever. But I'm telling you, when I was sitting there in the crowd, and they're about to make an announcement, I had like a feeling it was going to be me.
Well, it definitely was, regardless. They picked you. I was just wondering, could you explain to the audience a little bit what life is like as an Omega Knot? And having been both, now that you've been to PAX East 2011, would you rather attend your next PAX as an Omega Knot or as just a normal civilian?
Well, I think when I explain what goes into being an Omega Knot, the answer to that question will become pretty obvious. So the deal is, the Omegathon is what you're actually there to do as an Omega Knot, which is a competition involving, I think it's usually four rounds. And in my year, and I think in the most recent year as well, it was done in pairs. So you had teams of two, and you were just randomly paired up. And it's single elimination. So, in the first round, for example, it was Mario Kart Double Dash, and, team against team, 2-on-2, and if you're eliminated, you're out. And it takes place over the course of the weekend. So every day there's, one or two of the rounds, and that's it. And so you say it like that, and then if you win, you get to go on a big trip to, like Europe, or to go to a video game convention or there or something, and it's really cool. So it's cool to win. But what's the best part about it actually has nothing to do with that, although, I do enjoy, people came and they watch your events, and it's cool to play games in front of people, and that's awesome. But the best part is you have this special badge as an Omega Knot, which allows you to skip any of the lines for anything. So you never have to line up. You don't have to line up for anything. And I tested this principle, I believe, as far as it will reasonably go. Any kind of line that I could think of to skip, I tried to skip. And I was never rebuffed. Never. I mean, the enforcers always were like, yep, right, you know, right to the front of the line. So, I mean, like, obviously the panel stuff, you know, skip to the front of the line on that. The concerts, no waiting around. Even at the on the show floor, when there would be lines to get into the most popular booths. So I think that Red Dead Redemption, for example, was at that PAX East. There was a huge line. You had to wait, you know, 2 hours or something to get in there. Right to the front of the line. You just skip. You go right in, and you do anything. It's like there's no way to describe how much this changes the experience.
I actually saw you cut in front of the concession stand in front of me. Watched you roll right up, grab a hot dog. Yeah.
The concession stand, the line to get stuff autographed by Gabe and Tycho, skip to the front of that line.
Really?
Only one I didn't try was to skip to the front of the bathroom line, right?
And that
probably would have been bridged too far.
Well, I'm actually impressed that you actually use those powers to skip through the autograph lines. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah, no, I was not that one. I was a little skeptical about that it was going to work, but no, the enforcers were like, go right to the front. It was crazy.
Wow.
And it was great. And people were actually pretty on the whole cool about it. I mean, the people I was cutting in front of basically accepted my representations that this was the way it worked. So, I mean, saying all that, obviously it's better to go as an Omega. I think that certain other badges, like the VIP badges, I think we'll do this, and maybe the band badges, maybe. Mm-hmm. And obviously, like, you know, Gabe and Tycho have their, you know, special whatever. They could do anything. But as a practical matter, as a regular person, this is as good as it's ever going to get to go to PAX, because it's just incredible. Now, you lose a little something. You lose a little something, because it's not like this time you spend in lines is totally wasted. So, you know, you can meet people and make friends and chat people up and whatever, and that's fun. But the thing is, like, you know, it's like 5% fun and like 95%, you know, not that fun because you're waiting around.
Yeah.
So the consequence is that, at least what I did, you know, this most recent year, is I just didn't do a lot of stuff that required a lot of waiting in line. So I spent much more time, you know, in the tabletop room, where, of course, you know, you really don't have to wait for anything. Or I spent time, you know, going to, you know, panels that weren't, you know, going to be so full that you had to line up hours in advance and things like that. And so, you know, it sort of changed the parts of the convention I experienced. And, you know, not necessarily for the worse, but it's definitely different.
So you mentioned the Omegathon. And I know a lot of your PAX East 2010 was spent preparing for that. Now, that do you consider that a drawback? Do you consider that an advantage to be able to play in the Omegathon? What was your take on that?
Well, the thing, so I did spend time. There was this one game, and it was Geometry Wars, and I'd never played it ever. I just sort of had missed it, and I knew it was going to be the next round. It was going to be the next day, and I wanted, you know, I'm very competitive. I like to win at stuff, and so I wanted to get ready, and I wanted to play this thing. So I spent a bunch of the first evening getting ready for this and sort of practicing up and, you know, and practicing, and then, you know, it didn't end up being enough, and that was the round I was eliminated. But I don't really see that as a drawback, because, you know, you don't have to do that. I mean, people I was, you know, other Omega Knots did not take it nearly as seriously. They just sort of had a good time, you know, did what they could, and, you know, showed up at the appointed times to try to compete. And, they, you know, they had a great time. And so it's not like you have to do that. I mean, the actual time commitment is something in the order of probably, you know, a couple of hours. It's a fun couple of hours. You're playing games and people are watching and it's cool. So there are essentially no drawbacks. I don't understand why people don't enter, because there are no downsides at all, really, that are significant. If you don't enter, shame on you. You've
got to
try to be Omega Knot.
And also, it seems like that the round two is by far the most competitive round, because round one is like a cattle call. It's like, you're an Omega Knot, and here's where you go, and it's some game that everyone's probably played at least once, and you haven't practiced in a million years because it's, you know, Super Mario Kart on a 64, and it's on a big screen, go. Then round two is the next day. You actually have time to think about it. You can prep for it. Round three is usually something on stage before a concert night, so it's like some kind of rock band type thing. And stage four is a mystery. So, like, really, stage two is the only one that would require boning up on, probably.
Right, exactly. I mean, with like rock band, I think they play on medium. I think you have to.
Right.
And so, you know, the skill sort of threshold is already, you know, you can't get that good at playing rock band on medium.
Right.
But I totally agree with that. I think round two is the tough round.
It's the key round.
Key round.
So, The other thing is, man, I feel like every single one of my PAXs has been better than the year before. Mm-hmm. But your first PAX, you were an Omeganaut. You got on stage with the fucking Proto Men. You hit on one of the Proto girls and went out on a date with her out in the convention. I was like, you're never going to top that PAX experience, right? Unless, Gabe adopts you as his son.
It seems hard to imagine how I would top it.
Right? So, I don't know. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's sort of weird that I sort of, when I was going to 2011, I thought, I'm going to have a good time. It's going to be great. But it's going to be hard to top that. Because in addition to that, it was also like my first PAX, right? Which
right.
is always going to be sort of special and
sure.
fun. I feel good about it. I mean, I had a good time in 2011. And I'm sure I'm going to keep enjoying it. And, it is weird, though, to sort of know that I've probably been to the best PAX I'll ever go to, but maybe not. Maybe I'll be wrong. And if I'm wrong, whatever I go to is going to be, it's going to have to be fucking great. So that's going to be good.
Well, when you get your VIP badge for being the crack legal correspondent for Blue Yonder, I mean, that's just going to be all access.
That'd be good. I do think they should recognize my specialness with some kind of badge.
Speaking of specialness, I've always thought, because you've got many talents, and I thought for sure when I first met you online that you would eventually become a software developer or some kind of IT career. You eventually went into the legal profession, and we'll talk about that later. But you also, I thought, were a talented writer, because we'd have like kind of freeform writing stuff in the different groups that we'd be in, and you always wrote these like really kind of, Terry Pratchett, Douglas Adams style absurdist satire pieces that were funny as hell.
Thank you.
I know you have family in the biz. Your mom is actually a published author. Have you ever thought about, do you have that itch or do you scratch it exclusively with Twitter and blogging and all that kind of stuff? Or do you think that you've got something more of that in you?
Well, I do. Well, first of all, thank you. That's very nice to say, and I'm glad you appreciated it. But I do really like writing. And one of the reasons I like being a lawyer is because law is actually a lot more writing than most people think. And I enjoy that part of it the most. I have definitely given serious consideration to trying to publish fiction. And the main thing is that right now I don't want to do that enough to give it the kind of care and attention that I know it takes. I mean, you meet people all the time who are like, oh, I want to write a book one day. And the truth is like writing a novel is an extremely difficult undertaking. And I've seen this my whole life growing up, how much energy it takes, how much discipline and focus and just time. And it takes a part of you and, you sort of never get that part back if you're going to do it right. So I don't want to do it enough yet to go through what I know it takes. Whether I ever will, I don't know. I do have, like you say, sort of other ways of scratching the itch. I really like, I enjoy the tweeting. I enjoy the tweeting. I don't blog really anymore, but I enjoyed that when I did it. It's possible. I think my mother, who is a professional novelist, I think she thinks I will. But I don't know if she's right about that.
Do you get to do, because every once in a while you'll see a legal decision handed down from a judge that's passed around on Slashdot or Hacker News where he just eviscerates a defense or a,
ruling?
The prosecutor. Yeah. He's either defense or prosecutor for being stupid and it's funny and snarky. Do you get to do a lot of clever writing in legal papers? Is it, because the way you talked about it, it's almost like, I guess, yes, I know there's a lot of writing in legal profession, but it seems like there'd be a lot of boilerplate and not much chance to be kind of snarky and creative and clever and funny.
Well, I think the chances to write well are there if you want to take them. And the reason most legal writing isn't very good is because it doesn't necessarily have to be good. I mean, a boring brief that isn't particularly well written can and often does still win, right? Because this isn't, it's not a writing contest. It sort of is supposed to be about figuring out what the law is. But if you want to take those opportunities, there's boilerplate in the law and plenty of it. And there are parts that are just sort of, routine, sort of rote recitation of, legal standards or whatever. But in everything that a lawyer writes, whether it's a brief or a judicial opinion or whatever, there's some meat, there's some argument in there where the sort of boilerplate is put to the side and you actually try to explain what your argument is and why you're right. And in the process of doing that, you can write as well as you want to write. You can write some really good stuff. And there are a lot of gifted, especially judges. I mean, there are judges who are just known to be very gifted writers and whose stuff can be read by a regular person with a, you know, potentially anybody with a high school education and, you know, pretty good knowledge of English can read this stuff. And, you know, I'm not going to say it's going to be, you know, better than The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but it's good. You know, it's enjoyable, and you can write that well if you want to. And I think most of the time people just choose to do otherwise, and I think that's why.
I hear that actually Stephen King is considering a legal career, so that might just change the whole face of that game.
That's perfect. It's perfect. That guy's going to be good.
This is probably a good time to transition into the next section of our show. Now that we know everything about your personal life, we know all the intimate details about you.
I don't know all the intimate
details. No, I know them all. let's move into your profession, into the legal aspects. Why would you suggest that anyone go into a legal career?
Or why did you personally?
Or why did you personally, yeah.
Well, I did because what happened was I mean, the sort of biographical sort of story behind it is I was a college debater. I was getting my degree in computer science. I was a junior or something, maybe a sophomore. And I had just finished a summer working in a very large IT department for, you know, a gigantic insurance company. And I did not enjoy it. I was not doing the kind of stuff that had made me like computer science as a discipline, and I started to realize that the only thing that I could do in computer science that would sort of be the things that I liked about it would essentially be an academic career as a sort of, you know, graduate student and eventually maybe professor of computer science, right? Because mm-hmm. That's where the really interesting sort of theoretical stuff happens, and, you know, in production and sort of day-to-day life of, you know, of writing code and or doing whatever, that wasn't the stuff that moved me. Not to say a lot of people don't enjoy it, because a lot of people do enjoy it, but I wasn't moved by that. And I didn't really want to be an academic. So I was sort of casting around for other things. And my debate partner at the time said, you know, I don't know why you've never considered going to law school, because you seem like you probably enjoy it. We have a lot of friends who've gone into it who could tell you about it. It seems like, you know, maybe law, maybe you would really like it. And so that kind of got me thinking, and then I eventually just sort of decided to do it. Now, the only reason anyone should go to law school is if they want to be a lawyer, which seems like duh, right? But all the time, people go to law school for all sorts of other reasons. Like, primarily, they say that, you know, you can do a lot with a legal degree. Yeah, it's true. I guess you can, but that's a very expensive credential to not use for the main thing that it's for. And, you know, those people inevitably end up unhappy in law school. They don't like it very much, because it is really about being a lawyer. So, you know, why do it? I mean, you should do it if you think that the actual work of lawyers, which you should try to find out about before you go, sounds like something you'd be happy doing on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, for a lot of people, the answer to that, when they sort of figure out what it is lawyers do, is no. That doesn't sound very fun, in which case you should probably definitely save yourself the, you know, $100,000 or whatever you'd spend going through law school and do something else. But, you know, I love it. So I'm very happy I went.
So you're a lawyer. You said you work for the Justice Department. Now, within the Department of Justice, is it all just kind of like one homogenous department? Do you have different divisions? And if so, tell us a little bit specifically what you do and how you fit in there.
Sure. So the Justice Department is very big. There are thousands and thousands of people who work for the Justice Department, and a lot of attorneys. And so there are definitely different divisions. And the specific section I work in is the civil division. So the division that is not concerned with criminal sort of prosecutions at all or anything like that. And specifically, I work on the appellate staff. So I practice exclusively in the courts of appeals of the United States. So, people have heard of the Ninth Circuit, for example, that's a federal mm-hmm. court of appeal that I practice in. What we do, the sort of stuff that comes our way, is sort of any matter that's not, you know, a criminal case. So, for example, if people have read about, challenges to the healthcare law, we are handling the defense of the healthcare law. If people have read about, you know, essentially the government participating in any high-profile case that isn't a criminal case, That's us. That's what we do. And it's very fun. It's very satisfying. It's very enjoyable. I've been able to have, you know, the nice thing about being a government lawyer is you get a lot of responsibility early, which makes up for the fact that, you know, you don't make as much money. But, you know, I've had two arguments so far, in the sort of year I've been in this, this section, and it's been really good.
Excellent. So when I picture this, I'm picturing like basically a scene from A Few Good Men. I know you're not arguing criminal cases, so it's probably not usually the case. But what is it like to argue in front of such a high level court, and how does it compare to what we might see in the movies?
Well, the deal is, so the main thing that's different, I think, is that in the courts of appeals and in the Supreme Court, you know, there's no jury. So it's just judges. It's a panel of judges. It's usually three judges on the courts of appeal, and of course, it's the nine justices in the Supreme Court. And the way the argument works is, you know, you have a set amount of time, maybe half an hour per side. You go up there and you sort of start presenting your argument, and you are immediately interrupted with questions from the panel. And you answer their question, and you're probably, your answer will likely be interrupted as well. And it's a back and forth much more than a sort of like monologue presentation. And this is more true the more the important the case is and the sort of higher you go. So a Supreme Court oral advocate, you know, the first thing that they're told is, you know, you're probably not going to get a second sentence out at the beginning. So you better make sure your first one is pretty good, because after that, you know, it's fair game and you're going to get interrupted with what the judges want to talk about. You know, most of the so it's very interesting. It's, you know, it's really like adrenaline filled, and you're sort of like up there, like actually in a back and forth for, you know, however much time you're up there. I mean, there's nothing really quite like it that I've done. But you know, it's also about, you know, dry points of law, because, you know, these are courts of law, and so they're not really interested in sort of like figuring out, you know, what really happened in a certain set of facts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, movies thus tend to focus a little more on, like, you know, and you know, for example, there are also no witnesses. It's just you and the judges, so you're not cross-examining anybody, things like that. So, you know, whether or not that would make for good TV, I don't know, I would watch it, but I think it's pretty different from what we see most of the time.
Now, how, because that blows my mind, how does that actually work? How is it that you get one sentence into your argument and you're immediately cut off with, yeah, whatever, this is what I want to know about? Like, this, so I'm assuming that the justices all have both sides of your argument, basically, and they've read it in advance, and they kind of know what parts they agree with, what parts they don't agree with, and what parts, and they're just trying to use you to drill through to the information they want.
Exactly right. So they, before you get to the argument, you will have filed briefs that set forth, you know, in detail your legal arguments, and they've read those and they're familiar with them. And so there's really the argument is really not to sort of get out that those sort of basic outline main arguments. They want to probe the difficulties with your position. They want to sort of get into, you know, the sort of way these things interact, and, you know, sometimes they want to convince one another. I mean, sometimes, you know, a question for you is really sort of directed at one of their colleagues who they know is sort of listening, and they're trying to persuade this person sort of but through asking you a question. And it's, you know, it's live fire. I mean, it's a lot of fun, but it is, it can be very, you know, it's very, very intense.
So have anyone ever, like, actually screamed objection in the court? That's what I want to know. Like Phoenix Wright
style.
I like
to do that. I like to do it a little bit before everybody gets there.
Okay. Probably the best idea. Are there any outrageous things you could tell us that have happened while you've been in court that you could maybe talk about?
Outrageous things.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is outrageous, but it certainly was. It was surprising. So my first argument, it was in New York City in the Second Circuit. I was very excited. It was the first one I'd ever done. I'm up there, and I'm so excited. And I was scheduled last on the docket for the day. There were three or four cases being argued before me, and one of them was it was an immigration case where the sort of question was whether the immigration authorities had rightly ordered a certain person removed from the United States. Like, okay, so far it seems pretty routine. There are lots of those cases, but when the who I thought was going to be the lawyer for the immigrant herself stood up, I realized it was actually the immigrant who had been ordered removed. which is unusual because usually, you know, usually, I mean, sometimes people appear, it's called appearing pro se, like for yourself. Mm-hmm. And you sometimes get that in briefs. If people can't afford to hire a lawyer, they'll sort of try to write something on their own. But I'd never seen this at an argument before. And then the other thing was she, you know, her command of English was very sketchy. And so she sort of was trying to kind of engage in a back and forth with the court, but it was very like uncomfortable. And you sort of like wondered why the court had scheduled argument to sort of put this, you know, poor woman who, you know, ordered removed from the United States and is having a hard enough time through this bizarre spectacle. Mm-hmm. I had no idea why they would want to do that. It was grim. It was grim. Oh. Sort of not, it was not great. Not great.
Man, I was hoping for like a naked judge or
a fist fight
between like members on the bench.
Yeah. Well,
speaking of higher courts of the land, Supreme Court and appellate court, we have been talking in our offline, or I guess online chats, but off-cast chats, about the Supreme Court ruling, which I believe has been brewing for some time, and it centers around a California land that seeks to ban or limit violent video games. And the one that, like, Postal 2 is one of the ones that kind of sparked this controversy, and the Mortal Kombat remake. You have an update on like kind of what that case, because we're going to start talking about video games for a bit. What's that case about? Yeah. What is the potential? I mean, what's the fight for, and what do we have to be afraid of as geeks or hopeful?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So there's this case is out of California, and what the law says is that it is illegal to sell a violent video game to anyone under 18. Unless the game has this odd formulation, like substantial literary, artistic, or political value for minors. You know, and who knows exactly what that means.
Is this like the Miller Law for video games?
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly like what it is. It's very strange. And so every court before this, a bunch of the courts of appeals have considered laws like this. And all of the courts of appeals have all said that they're unconstitutional, that they're a restriction on freedom of speech that isn't justified by any of the sort of exceptions to the usual rule that you can't restrict what people want to say to each other. So, all right, so far, so good. And I think all those rulings are correct. And, you know, there had been no courts of appeals at all that had come out the other way. And then the Supreme Court decides to take this case rising out of California and the Ninth Circuit. And, you know, by itself, that doesn't mean they think that the decision below is wrong. I mean, sometimes they just want to clarify the state of the law. And, you know, so sometimes they affirm a decision after they decide to take it and listen to it. And so, you know, based on the oral argument, so they granted the case about roughly a year ago, right? And they heard it, I think it was argued in September, maybe, of last year.
That
so the way
right.
the Supreme Court works is their term starts in October. Well, it obviously wasn't argued in September. I think it was argued in maybe November. The Supreme Court term starts in October. It runs through June. And all of the cases that are argued that term are decided by the end of the term. So you know for sure that by the end of June, if your case was argued that term, you're going to get a decision one way or another. Okay, so far so good. We hear the argument in November. And based on the justice's comments at oral argument, it seemed like everything was going to be just fine. It seemed like there was a sort of clear majority of the court that thought these laws were not okay, that there was no – you couldn't just restrict speech because it was violent. We have no sort of history or tradition of that in the United States, whether it's for minors or not. So it seemed like great. So far, so good. Well, that was a long time ago. And now there is only one day left in the term. It's Monday. There are four decisions outstanding, and this is one of them. And you might think that if it was going to be sort of just easy peasy, they would have written this and released it months ago. But they haven't. And, you know, no one knows why. It's possible that somebody is preparing, you know, an epic dissent. It's going to be very long. And sort of that's why the opinion is getting held up. It's possible that the sort of good guys lost some votes along the way. And now, you know, there's sort of been a struggle over what the outcome is going to be, which would obviously be pretty bad. Or it's possible that, you know, it's just a long, complicated opinion on both sides and it'll come out the way everyone thought and everything's going to be fine. But, you know, I really think that if anyone who cares about the, you know, video games in the United States should pay attention Monday morning, 10 o'clock Eastern time, when this decision will be announced, because it's obviously going to be It has a potential to do, you know, great damage to the sort of state of affairs in this country. So, obviously, I sort of tip my hat a little bit on how I hope it comes out. But, you know, I don't know. It's going to be very interesting.
Let me ask you, like, a devil's advocate position. How is this different than movie theater chains requiring minors to show ID, to prove that they're 17 or older, or have a parent to sell them a rated R movie ticket?
Well, the reason it is because that movie theater rating system is voluntary, which a lot of people may not know, but it is. It is imposed by the Motion Picture Association of America and as a sort of condition on their sort of member theater groups. And, you know, to get the prints, you might have to agree to do this. But it's, you know, there's no law at all that says a 16-year-old kid can't go into, you know, a video store and buy a DVD of Schindler's List because it's sort of deemed too violent. There's no law that says anything like that. And it would actually be rather shocking if you could have a law like that, because it's one thing to say, you know, we as movie theater chains sort of we want the clientele we want, and we're going to let in people over a certain age and not under a certain age for certain movies. Fine, that's a business decision. Businesses can decide to do that, and it's not, you know, none of my business. But for the government to say that we've decided that people who aren't, you know, 18 yet can't know about violence in the world, that's pretty shocking. That would be very surprising, and much different than, I mean, anything we've ever had in this country before. I mean, it'd be positively warping to get to the age of 18 having never learned about this sort of, like, I mean, like, look, like it or not, violence is a part of human affairs. It's part of human history, and it's a, you know, it's part of the way the world works. And to get to 18 without sort of ever having been exposed to a story about it, never being allowed to, you know, you can't read, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey because there's too much violence in them. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy that the government would be able to do that. So I think that's why it's different.
Especially to single out video games above all other forms of media.
Right. Yeah, very strange. Like, why? I mean, if this stuff is warping people's brains, then, you know, high school football is pretty violent, right? Why
warps their brains. I mean, literally warping their brains with the concussion scares that we've been reading about.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, it just seems like we have enough honest-to-goodness problems and not enough time for, you know, made-up ones like this. It's just it's stupid. It's amazingly – the entire concept is brain-dead from its inception. But, you know, we will see what happens.
All right. We're going to talk about a couple of questions that kind of deal with the intersection of IP law and video games. One thing that I've been annoyed with a trend is that gaming content creators are being a lot more possessive of their server space. And in fact, the last few times I've been to a LAN party, we could not run our own local servers. We had to use the officially approved, blessed servers to play on, which gave us a hard time. You know, you had to go through all this matchmaking crap instead of, like, here's everybody in a room, join the server. Yeah,
higher pings.
And, like, you know, it just led to, like, it didn't feel like a real net party. And if we
this is a big problem in StarCraft tournaments, because in StarCraft 2, there's no way to play locally.
And Blizzard's been, you know, one of the assholes that's kind of been at the root, because I remember the first times I had an argument, well, not an argument, but I guess a mutual kind of, like, bitch session with you, was over to BNetD Project. Do you remember that? That was, like, they had, you know, Blizzard's has a battle net, and someone came and reverse engineered it all legally. They didn't, like, uncompile it. They just, you know, like, black box reverse engineered a battle net client or server so that you could play off the Blizzard's official stuff, and they got shut down through legal threats. I'm not sure. I think it was just a threat. It wasn't actually something that came down through case law. Where do projects stand that try to replace official releases and servers, you know, with some sort of homebrew or unofficial server piece of software?
Well, it's murky, and so let me lay out a little bit what the sort of tools that companies use to fight these things. The basic deal is this: so, okay, you've got a game, and it's copyrighted. Okay, code's copyrighted. That's fine. Now, to install that game, or even to run it, you need to make a copy of the software. You need to copy it to disk, and then you need to copy it from disk into memory. That's making a copy of something copyrighted, which usually, you know, you're not allowed to do without permission. Now, of course, every game comes with what is termed a license that you have to agree to before you install it or do anything with it. And that license sort of says, we're going to give you permission to do this thing you're not allowed to do, which is make a copy of our copyrighted software. But here are the conditions on that license. And one of the conditions is, you know, you don't do stuff like BNetD. You don't run it on a non-authorized server. You don't do any sort of whatever behavior we don't like. We're going to say that's a condition of the license. And if you do one of those things, the argument goes, you have violated the terms of the license. And that means that you are now, you know, the license is sort of revoked by your behavior. And you are now making copies of our game without our permission. And that's a copyright violation, right? When you run that game to do something that's not covered by the license, you are making a copy illegally, and we can come get you. Now,
isn't that kind of so insane, just the premise, that like loading something from disk to RAM is making it a copy? And that's like saying when I read a book, my eyes convert the words into a signal in my brain, and it's making an unauthorized copy of my brain.
I think that is a serious objection, and it's possible for people to disagree about whether that's to say the least. Now, the other response people make is, well, you know, there's a provision of the copyright law that says any software you are allowed to make a copy of any software you own for the purposes of installing it on your computer or making a backup. And this is Section 117 of the copyright law. You're allowed to do that. That is a right that is granted to you in the same, you know, piece of law that grants the copyright holder their rights in the first place. So you might say, well, why doesn't that pretty much cover this? And the answer, as you can undoubtedly predict, is they say, ah, well, you don't own the software. We're just licensing it to you. Oh, of course you are. Because I was surprised, I was confused because I went to the store and I bought a box and I gave them money and I took my box home and I would have thought that I owned that box. But as it turns out, I don't. You are the real owner of this thing that I just paid money for and I'm going to keep for an indefinite period of time in my house. I would have thought, so usually when I go to the store and I give them money and I take something home, I own that thing. Very surprised to find out that sort of by sort of saying so on the end user license agreement, you can convert my purchase into a license. You can sort of tell what I think of this argument. But that's the argument they make, and they have not been totally unsuccessful with these kinds of things. It's unsettled. There's different law in different courts, and it's sort of never really been cleared up by the Supreme Court, and may never be. But you know, just the threat of litigation itself, which is very expensive, is generally enough to deter these projects, unfortunately, because litigation is very costly. So that's basically the deal. The way these projects get shut down is by using the copyright law and sort of threats of infringement lawsuits to get to the point where it's just too expensive to develop them.
So this is probably a good time for me to ask a question that one of our listeners, the Don Staffa, you probably have heard of him. Sure. Has asked on our forums. He wants to know about ROMs. And since we're all kind of old school gamers here, this kind of pertains to all of us. I know I'll admit to downloading a ROM before of software that I actually own the cartridge for, things like that.
Mm-hmm. I'll go one step further. I've downloaded a ROM to software I've do not physically have in my possession.
Tisk, I hear the sirens already.
Uh-oh.
So what is the legality of that? If you own a cartridge, let's take it back all the way to there, because we don't really want to talk about the licensing or whatever, but if you own the actual cartridge, what is the legality of downloading then a ROM or a copy of that software onto your computer to play it emulated?
Yeah, so I think this is, unsurprisingly, this would be a gray area. And I think that it is, I think there is a good argument, and I'm not, you know, it might not win, but I think there is a good argument that the very same Section 117 rights that we were just talking about, where when you own a piece of software, like a, you know, video game cartridge, you have the right to make a copy for example, backup purposes. That's unquestionable. Mm-hmm. I think there is a good argument that this situation would be covered by that, because you're saying, like, look, I own the cartridge, and the way I'm making my copy for backup purposes is I'm downloading it over the internet, for example.
Into your RAM.
into your hard drive. Computer where my backup mm-hmm. will live, right? And if I lose my cartridge, then I won't lose the software that I paid for and that I own. And the interesting thing is with video game cartridges, there aren't end user license agreements. You know, right? you don't click through I agree or anything like that. There's really no license. Mm-hmm. So I think that you would have a good argument that that would be an exercise of your Section 117 rights. Because you know, how else are you going to make a backup of your video game software, right? How are you going to do it? I mean, how am I going to back up a Game Boy cartridge unless I have except onto my computer? I mean, it seems like a good argument to me. I'm not an expert in this particularly, and I don't go out there and do it on my say so. But I think that there is a reasonable case to be made that that is a lawful exercise of your rights. Now, obviously, downloading stuff that you don't own, that's bad. Don't do that. You know, that's copyright Sure. infringement, and whether you want to run the risk of doing that or not is obviously up to you. But I think there's a good case that your friend is within the bounds of the law, but it's unsettled.
Yeah, so don't make copies of the show, anyone, because there's a horribly extensive license on this thing.
By listening to this show, you hereby agree that all the hot babes you meet are the property of Ian Samuel.
Stated by an actual lawyer, so you're in trouble. I did want to ask one more follow-up question with that. How far do those licenses extend? Can they basically say that they own your children by opening these boxes, by running this software?
It's a good question, right? I mean, if they can just sort of unilaterally... So for example, if anything you sort of click I agree to becomes part of the license and uh-huh. to do anything that the license doesn't let you do is copyright infringement, I mean, presumably they could say by clicking I agree, you hereby, for example, agree to, be a subscriber of our service for the next 10 years. And if you don't do it, that's copyright infringement because you're outside uh-huh. the terms of the license. I mean, you can take this to clearly absurd ends, which is why I think that, these click-through licenses cannot actually function to deprive you of ownership of a thing you've bought. But,
have they actually challenged the legality of end-user licenses agreements?
There have been cases about this. There was a case in the Ninth Circuit not too long ago about World of Warcraft bots, for example, mm-hmm. which violate the terms of Blizzard's license. And they sued somebody. Blizzard sued somebody. I don't know if it was the makers of the bots or players or what. And the conclusion of the Ninth Circuit, as I recall, was, okay, you don't own the software, but the bots aren't illegal, and it's not copyright infringement, and then it's kind of technical distinction that I won't bother everybody with. But there have been cases about this, and they're litigated, and, groups like the EFF and places like that, and the, Software Freedom Foundation, or Free Software Foundation, maybe both. They get involved in these kinds of things, and they have not been totally unsuccessful. So, this is a live thing. This is a fight that's ongoing.
Hmm. Well, we're definitely going to talk about the EFF and some of those software foundations later. But real quickly, I wanted to kind of direct us towards the IP concerns around the cloud-based music services like Amazon and Google have been launching lately, and even iTunes is starting to go cloud-based. Mm-hmm. And they're being sued. They're being sued by the media companies. So I was wondering what you think of the most recent developments with Amazon basically just pushing into the market and saying, challenge us.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it's, it's nice. I think it's good in the following respect. So I don't know if Amazon is going to end up winning their legal fight with the labels. I really don't. I think that they've got a pretty good argument. I think that all we're providing is an opportunity for you to store your music online. You upload the files and we store the files, and then we have a little player for the files you upload. It's no different than Dropbox, really. And it sounds like a good argument to me. But whether they win or not, I'm glad that this is happening, because the only way that you ever get good results in the sort of realm of like user rights and IP and copyright and stuff like that is if you have moneyed interests on both sides who uh-huh. can afford to litigate this as part of their business. So music labels can crush individual listeners because a regular person doesn't have the legal wherewithal to sort of fight forever, even if they're completely in the right, right? Sure. Amazon obviously thinks this is a bet that they're willing to back up with. I mean, they knew the day they did this, of course, that the music labels, whom they did not seek the permission of, they knew they were going to object to this, and they knew that that objection was going to come in the form of litigation. So they were obviously prepared to fight to do this. Well, that's good, because if they win and they get a very user-friendly result out of it, that would obviously be great for everybody. Regardless of whether they – I mean, it's the best chance we have, I guess I would say. You know, the fact that Amazon and Google are sort of lined up on the side of like, you know, this is not copyright infringement. Users are permitted to do this. That's the best hope for a good result.
I was personally very happy to see it because, like you said, you need the big money interests. Because the music industry has basically been very predatory in regards to individuals and going after the small guy.
Right.
And now when Amazon comes into the market and just says, we're going to do this, then they can't get the out-of-court settlements that they've been getting with individuals. This is going to either go to the top or they're going to drop it, one of the two.
Right. Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
So I think it's great, yeah.
So I think it's very good.
We've been talking a lot about intellectual property disputes. And intellectual property is this kind of like nebulous term that embraces trademarks and copyright and licensing and a lot of different things that we kind of treat as one in the geek community. Do you feel that on a fundamental level, are all IP concerns, all intellectual property linked together, or should they be treated as distinct things? Like a patent is this, and, you know, a copyright is this, and a trademark is that, or should there be some kind of like one, you know, universal binding kind of law that supersedes all this stuff? Those are just basically ideas.
Right. I mean, well, they're obviously like I try to keep I don't know anything about trademarks and like trade secrets and sort of some of the like frontier sort of like edge stuff in this world. But I do think that there are important differences between patents and copyrights that people should keep in their head a little more clearly than they do, because like they're four different things and they should be treated differently. So, for example, like we have in the patent world, patents are all by registration, right? You have to register for a patent and like prove to an office of the government that you've invented something new and sort of lay out how you did it in order to get a monopoly to do that thing for a fixed period of time. And that's, you know, that's one – the reasons you might want to have a system like that are sort of separate from the reasons that you might want to have a system of copyright where it's automatic, for example. You know, as soon as you take a picture, you've got a copyright in it. It's for a much longer time. And patent lasts 17 years and then it's done. A copyright lasts, I mean, you know, as a practical matter, forever. So I do try to keep them straight in my head because, you know, they are four different things. There are a lot of things like, you know, I tend to think, for example, that software patents are an example of like, this is an area we should just be dealing with through copyright. You know, if you have a copyright on software you've written, that's one thing. But to patent this sort of idea of an algorithm just seems to me to be, you know, really, really absurd. I try to keep them straight in my head, but they're obviously related. I mean, they're obviously cousins in some sense.
Sure. Speaking of that, we actually have another listener question.
Well, I had one more follow-up that, too.
Okay.
Because, like, I think of in 1984, they had Sony versus Universal, I think.
Yeah.
That kind of, like, solved for a generation of technology a lot of intellectual property disputes. Like, can I make a recording of a television show and play it back on a recording device? And, you know, because the court ruled in the way they did, it really blew the lid off of a lot of things we take for granted for now, like, you know, time shifting content, DVR, stuff like that was all made possible by that ruling.
So they say it's fair use for you to make a copy of a program for you to watch it later. That's
right.
What the decision says.
So, and that kind of solved a lot of things until the internet era. Do you think we'll have a similar, like, landmark law or landmark ruling that will solve the tension between content producers, consumers, and pirates? Because they all have, I mean, consumers just want their stuff to work and stuff to play. Mm-hmm. Content producers want to get paid for producing content, and pirates just want to rip it off for free. There's got to be a way to protect the rights of a consumer without just, you know, giving the keys to the kingdom away to the pirates. You know, I mean, we could argue about what's wise, what the content producers should do, blah, 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 but what do you think there'll be a nice, neat bow of a law that is wrapped around that basically it indemnifies consumers and allows content providers to effectively prosecute pirates?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. I think that basically, like, if you're a consumer in the world right now, like, if you listen to music or you watch, you know, movies or you play video games, I think you basically right now have, like, a couple of problems. The first problem you have is that copyright lasts way too long, right? Well, the Supreme Court already heard that case, and they basically said Congress can keep going back and extending it forever and ever. So that problem doesn't feel like it's going to get solved. The other problem you have is that to the extent that all of your stuff is burdened with, you know, crappy digital rights management stuff, it makes it impossible to, you know, take your movie that you bought on iTunes and play it on, you know, some other device. That doesn't seem like a thing that the law can really solve, because people are just going to have to decide that they don't want to pay money for that, because you wouldn't want to make that illegal. I mean, digital rights management is a bad idea, but it would be hard to think of a way to make it unlawful that wouldn't also, like, be have a lot of unintended side consequences. So so I don't really see this as a sort of a problem the law is going to solve. I mean, I think in the long run, like, the solution to the problem you're talking about is, you know, it's like it's when it is more convenient and better to pay for stuff at a reasonable price, you will get enough of the market that you can make money. So this is why Steam is great. Steam is, I mean, Steam uses digital rights management. It absolutely does. It is a DRM system. Mm-hmm. But it's like the best one you've ever used, because instead of making it harder than it used to be to play games on just that you would install from a CD, it's so much better, because you can, you know, you can install it, you know, on delete it and then install it again later, or install it on a, you know, different computer that you own, or stuff like that. And so as a result, you know, I think a lot of people who might have pirated games in the past will go on Steam and pay, you know, $5 on a Steam sale, and, you know, content producer makes money. You know, there's some protection against piracy. Consumer gets to play a game he wants. Sort of everybody wins. So, you know, this is why, you know, iTunes is a, you know, the iTunes store, I think, displaced casual piracy for a lot of people, because it's just more convenient and the price is reasonable.
True.
So, yeah.
So you mentioned that you think it's not going to be a problem solved by the law, but is there any threat right now that someone will try to litigate this or try to make laws to cover this and royally F it up?
Been any movements? There's like, for example, there's the, like, Protect IP Act, which expands and, you know, criminalizes just an amazingly stupidly large amount of stuff. You know, even linking to a website, as I understand the Protect IP Act, if you link to a website that is accused of copyright infringement, you're on the hook for, like, you know, a federal crime, essentially. I mean, it's just – it's beyond ridiculous. The other thing that we're seeing is a lot of moves to make certain, like, you know, like digital locker services, you know, like, you know, websites where you can sort of store files and send a link to them and they can download for free, to make those illegal or to make them, you know, sort of more regulated or whatever. I think Britain passed a law that did something like that in the very recent past. So there's always going to be, I mean, these threats are not going away, and this sort of copyright maximalism where we just got to expand you know, the legal rights that content owners have, that's not going away. But you know, so we gotta stop that.
Okay, so that kind of brings us back around to the trademark question that was asked by Madbrew, I think, on our forums.
Yeah, Madbrew he's all about RPG systems, and he's got like this really unique take on he's got a unique concern about copyright law, because there's a lot of things like game rule, core rule mechanics can't be copyrighted.
Copywritten. I don't know what it is.
They can't.
It's
but,
copyrighted.
But you can take, like, proper names of things and trademark them. And that's kind of like, you know, what D&D did. They're like, you know what? In 3.5, screw it. We're going to release all our rules under the open gaming license, since people can take them anyway. But we are going to protect vigorously the concept of a beholder or a Lich King, I guess. Although, I don't know. I think Blizzard stole that from them.
When they named their game.
It's like, so, and we're going to protect our art, the stuff that our artists make, the things that make D&D great, but, you know, go run wild with the D20 rule set. So that's kind of like informs this next question that he asks.
And I'm just going to read it verbatim. He says, I know short phrases, names, and titles cannot be copyrighted, but they can be protected via trademark. How well can proper names and titles of elements presented in a work be protected by trademark? For instance, if a tabletop game has a mechanic called Lubert's Rod of Golden Showers, presented within the rules, but not used to market or otherwise identify the product, does the publisher have any legal ground for litigation against another publisher that also makes use of the name?
Yeah, fortunately, the answer to that question is I don't know. The truth of the matter is trademark law is not really something I know that much about. I mean, it sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Doesn't it feel like you kind of should? Somebody uses your rod of golden showers, it isn't you. Don't you feel like you should kind of be able to get money from that guy?
I would feel violated, yes.
Yeah, I feel like you should be able to get money from that guy. So, yeah, I don't know. See, this is why I like that disclaimer at the beginning, because I can just guess, and no one can say that it's legal advice. So, yeah, as a practical matter, I don't know.
We don't accept I don't knows in this podcast, so theorize, Mr. Data. No.
Theorize? I think you probably, you're probably pantsed. You probably can't get anything.
The other question he had was about the, we kind of briefly touched on this, the Copyright Term Expansion Act of 1988. He wanted to know what your thoughts concerning the protection of corporate IP was. He says his stance is the current extension should be rolled back to original specs. I think it does the opposite of its constitutional intent, which is to promote creativity.
And he mentioned the Mickey Mouse Act, as it was so titled.
Right.
Right, the Sonny Bono thing. Yeah. Well, I agree with that. I mean, I think so. I mean, the Constitution says that copyrights are to be secured for limited times. Okay, that's actually in Article 1 of the Constitution. To me, if Congress can extend and extend and extend a copyright term indefinitely, that is no longer of a limited time in any practical sense. And the economic rationale for it is non-existent, because if the argument for copyright is we have to incentivize creators so that they can get a reasonable return on whatever they make, Mickey Mouse is already made, right? And so it can't be, you know, the incentives are already done operating on the creation of Mickey Mouse. So I think that, you know, the Sonny Bono thing, I mean, I'm not familiar with a legal academic who sort of works in the realm of copyright anywhere who thinks that was a good idea or is even mildly supportable by anything other than just interest group politics. So, I mean, yeah, that's my answer.
That's basically where I fall on it too.
It sounds like it's going to be up to we the people to be basically, if this comes up and Congress extends it again, to get awareness out and be like, this is bullshit, this is going to mean your jobs.
Yeah, I think so. It is it was like a 17-year – I don't remember how long the extension was, but I remember a couple of months ago I was looking at it and I realized that in the next few years – the sort of extra years from the Sonny Bono copyright thing were going to be over, and they were going to have to either do it again or let some of this stuff go into the public domain. And I think that the last time it happened, it was in the like late 90s, and it was the internet and was not quite a thing yet. I mean, people were online, I was online, but it had not had the mass sort of impact that it has now. And I'll be very interested to see what that fight looks like, because it's one that, you know, the every person and sort of politically interested individual on the internet is going to obviously, you know, want to say something about. So I'll certainly be paying attention.
And we didn't have the internet back then for us all to kind of organize and educate.
Yeah. It was very different.
I was going to say, isn't that number, the amount of years that it's protected, approaching a lifetime now? Isn't it going to be harder to justify it once it's over someone's natural lifetime?
Well, it's actually like right now, it's already over that.
It is, okay.
Like it's like the creator's lifetime plus, I want to say like 70 years or something. I mean, it is a long, long time.
Wow.
Yeah, or maybe it's life plus 90 years. Whatever it is, we're way past life. I mean, that is the rearview mirror.
It's also kind of destroying the public domain, because stuff that would have been... You know, like right now on my Kindle, I have all these works from the 19th century that I've downloaded for free, and I'm not hurting Dickens or, you know, Tolstoy or any of those guys. But I cannot play Steamboat Willie on my BlackBerry.
Think of his estate, man. His estate. The pain you're causing.
Yeah, no, the Great Gatsby, for example. That's not – I don't think that's in the public domain. It's absurd that it's not.
Okay, so we've talked about some of the frightening IP precedents, I guess. But are there any really promising IP-related legal precedents that you've seen developing recently?
Promising.
<Uh-oh.
laughs> This another I don't know.
actually, yes. Actually, there is one. And this was a good one. So there is a thing in the patent law called inducement of patent infringement, where you're not the primary inducer, but you encourage someone else to induce to violate the patent. And you're liable as an infringer, just the same as if you'd done it yourself. Now, The Supreme Court this term confronted the following question. So to infringe a patent, you don't have to know about the patent. You don't have to know anything. Mm-hmm. If you have a patent for a certain kind of vacuum cleaner and I build that vacuum cleaner, I infringe the patent and I owe you money, whether I knew you had a patent or not, right? Doesn't matter how hard I looked. Doesn't matter anything. It's strict liability. The question in the case was is inducement of infringement the same way? So if, for example, if I encourage you, if I hire a factory to build me a bunch of vacuum cleaners, for example, they're probably violating the patent directly, and that's their problem. But am I liable for violating the patent if I am inducing someone else to do something that in fact violates the patent, but I don't know there's a patent out there? Mm-hmm. And the answer, hearteningly, was no. To be liable as an inducer, you have to know about the existence of the patent. And so that was, it's not a big deal, but it's nice. And it really, because software companies really cared about this big time, because they get hit with tons of, sort of patent troll stuff all the time. And they really care about the inducement rules. And so they were big participants in this case and came out the good way. So how about that?
Sounds good. It's just a shame there are no other good legal precedents happening right now.
Yeah, there hasn't been a lot of action on the copyright front recently. I mean, other than this terrible legislation that's being proposed,
The IP Act. Protect IP. Let's talk about a little bit, maybe not legal, but it's something I think you got an opinion on. What role does WikiLeaks and independent journalists play in our future? Can newspapers and that kind of in-depth journalism survive in an environment where anyone can leak any information out instantaneously and anyone can write a reasonably informed opinion and publish it anywhere instantly?
Well, I think I think journalists are going to be just fine. I don't think that the WikiLeaks model is particularly sustainable because it involves – I want to phrase very carefully my comments about WikiLeaks, because they are – in fact, I think I should say nothing about WikiLeaks. I'm going to say nothing about that. I'll just want to talk about journalism. Journalists are going to be fine. And the success of, I think, places like Talking Points, Memo, and a lot of the sort of online-only journalism outlets, or like even places like Politico, prove that you can run a business and make money selling news online. You can do it. People are doing it every day. Now, the old newspapers, the New York Times and Washington Post, I don't know. Their business model was built for a completely different kind of era. And, I'm a lot less sure about those guys. What I know for sure is that local newspapers, they're pretty much dead. There's maybe a market for like one or two big English language newspapers in the United States. Like, the New York Times, I think, is going to survive. It'll probably survive in some form. But, the Pueblo Chieftain, the paper of my hometown, No, it's not going to happen. What's the argument for it? You can get online and learn everything that's going to be in the Pueblo Chieftain for free. Local news is very well handled by like local bloggers. I mean, I learned plenty about my DC neighborhood through reading a couple of blogs, and these are hobbyists doing it for free. And the reality is it's going to be very hard for those places to make money. And I think we're going to see a rise in sort of like mid-level petty corruption in small cities as a result, because the sort of local newspaper watchdog is going to be gone. There's going to be all sorts of sort of grift and corruption that unfortunately we're just never going to know about. And it's not good, but I don't see how it
– See, I thought you'd say the opposite, that like lots of large metropolitan areas or at least the mid – like the Indianapolises of the world are not going to have a newspaper record. But there would be ones at a local level because, again, yeah, there might be a local blogger for like D.C. and Denver, Colorado. But I don't think there's going to be one for like Greenfield, Indiana.
Clearwater, Florida. Times, how do they make money? I mean, why are people going to pay for that?
That's a good question. I just wonder if, the only problem with local bloggers covering it is how do you get, like, if I'm a person new to the area and I want to know about current events, I could call the local news. I could look up newspapers in the phone book and call them and get a subscription. Boom, I'm plugged in. It's a lot harder to find the blogger of record, you know, for like these little places. And I just wonder, it's like, that's the, if we could only find a way to get this information better organized, I guess. So, you know, and have some kind of transparency over it too, because that's the other thing that you miss with, you know, a traditional journalist editorial approach is that, you know, are these sources vetted? Is this guy just making shit up? Mm-hmm. You don't know, you know. Is he really blowing the lid off the mayor scandal, or is he just, you know, making something up because he's a political hack? That stuff
is
all
possible. Although I have to say, while you were talking, I Googled Indianapolis blogger of record, and the first page of Google results, I don't know, seems pretty promising to me. So we may already have the device to find stuff on the internet.
Right.
It's a lot better than the Yellow Pages, actually.
Okay.
But I mean, I don't totally disagree. I mean, I think that's it's an issue. I just don't understand how the, you know, Greenfield Times, how are they going to make money? I mean, if they're not going to be online, no one's going to read them. If they're going to be online, they're not going to be able to charge enough to pay a whole staff, probably, because their audience isn't big enough.
I'm just saying it kind of sucks, because I think you're right. You are going to see a lot of corruption and graft and things and, you know, police department shenanigans that are not going to get solved because there's nobody looking into it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It's too bad, but, you know, we'll work it out eventually, but there's going to be a period where it's not going to be good.
How do you see privacy landscape in 10 to 25 years? It seems like we're heading in a world that wants like one-way transparency. Like everybody wants to know what's going on in a citizen's lives, but you know, the other way where, you know, us knowing what's going on in the government lives and the people that are enforcing laws, that is being frowned upon. Where do you see privacy now that the internet and like all the surveillance that we've got and all this stuff can be networked? How do you see that being affected, good or bad?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think that the weird thing that I've started to be thinking about is that – so everyone knows we sort of like put ourselves online and we sort of, you know, document our own selves online and we sort of give away our privacy, right? That's a sort of trite observation. Everybody knows that.
Right.
What I've been thinking about lately is that, you know, in the process of doing that, we're sort of living these like – lives that are framed to be put online. Like you see people like taking pictures of what they're doing so that they can sort of post them to, you know, Flickr or Facebook or whatever.
Right.
And you realize that you're like you suddenly have like a directorial distance from your own experiences. And you know, you're doing stuff because it'll be fun to tweet about or whatever. And it's very like, I don't know if that's exactly like a privacy problem or what it is, but I'm starting to notice a little bit of that in my own life. Like I would, you know, I was on this big road trip and I was tweeting a bunch about it, and I sort of realized that like, you know, I was subtly being influenced to go to different places because I was like, that would, you know, that'll make a cool tweet. But it's like, that is the real sort of unexplored consequence of all of this stuff. And I have no idea how it's going to play out. I'm interested to sort of learn, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting that it is probably affecting our lives more than we even understand. Like you're saying, if we're distancing ourselves from the things that we're actually experiencing while we're experiencing them so that we can somehow document them for our friends and for
and no one cares
later. And no one cares.
Like, yeah. You see the jackass at the Grand Canyon looking through it through a viewfinder.
Uh-huh.
It's like you would actually have a better experience just sitting at home watching PBS in high def a presentation of the Grand Canyon. I mean, and like that's the thing. It's like no one cares. I don't want to see this guy's video that he's shooting. He's probably not going to watch it more than once in his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't just experience it?
Right. Yeah, it's very strange. And the sort of, you know, the sort of need to curate your own experiences for like the best presentation to other people, whether that's via social network or whatever else, is, I mean, I'm really not trying to be like the sort of like grumpy old man about this. Like, obviously, this stuff,
right.
You know, it's nice to be able to sort of to share this stuff with people, and it can obviously be a huge force for good, and it's not going away. But I just like just lately, I've been sort of thinking about, you know, what that's doing to people. Is it good? Is it bad? It's obviously some mix of the two, but it's I don't know. It's pretty interesting.
It'll be interesting to see what, like, you know, future archaeology looks like.
Yeah.
I mean, because we're recording everything. There'll be so much, like, I just wonder what that will look like, whether they just try, you know, they try to drill down the individual lives and tell a narrative there, or they try to draw overall conclusions from a culture. And, you know, like, you think about all the stuff that's on the internet.
Well, we've just ruined any type of archaeological expeditions by recording this. I mean, Blue Yonder is going to be the smear on the entire history of mankind.
It'll be sure. Like the fossilized corpolites. Like, they're looking at fossilized shit.
It's just, yeah.
And they can dig through to find how much corn was in the person's diet. But yeah, I mean, assuming that this will all last. I mean, that's another open question about when you start talking about archaeology and digital future, that, you know, we're not writing things on stone tablets, we're writing things on CDRs that are going to disintegrate and bits that are going to rot. So,
yeah, it's true. I mean, it's like when GeoCities went offline, they didn't save any of that. I mean, there was a big project to go through and archive all that had been put on GeoCities, but, you know, it's not inevitable that this stuff stays around.
And nothing of value was lost.
So we've been discussing some negative trends there. But as it relates to, like, IP law in the gaming industry, are there any effective ways for us to combat these sort of negative trends that we're seeing in those arenas?
Well, I think that there are, you know, there are two things. I mean, at the big level, at the sort of macro level, when legislation like the Protect IP stuff comes up, you've got to care, and you've got to, like, I mean, it's very important that you actually do stuff. You know, because the thing is, like, as weird as it sounds, senators and congressmen are bizarrely influenced by constituent mail and constituent phone calls. I mean, it doesn't always make a difference. It's not inevitable that, like, you know, obviously, you know, if they have like $1 million in campaign money on the line, you know, some like nice call from somebody is going to make a difference. But, you know, you got to do stuff like that. On a micro level, you know, the only thing you can do, I think, is, you know, don't give money to schemes that, like, aren't, you know, they don't provide like a relatively robust set of rights for you. I mean, so, you know, for example, I feel very comfortable buying music on iTunes because it's all DRM free. You know, I can do whatever I want with it, et cetera. You know, I feel a lot less comfortable about, like, you know, some of the games that are, you know, they're sort of crippled by design if you don't have an internet connection. Like, well, I don't want to give money to a company that thinks that's a good way to do it. So, you know, I just don't play those things. But, you know, I realize these are, like, both very trite answers, but I think they're trite because they're correct. There's really, like, that's what you have to do. And, you know, over time, I think things move the right direction. You know, music on iTunes used to be all DRM'd. Now it's not. Now there's an MP3 store with Amazon. There didn't used to be that before. So, you know, over time, these are businesses, and, like, they will work themselves out. But, you know.
Man, that's scary, because you're saying that letters and phone calls are what sways. And I feel like our generation, since we'll get on Slashdot and we'll bitch, or we'll, like, you know, make an ironic tweet, or get on Facebook and say something and share links. But that's, like, kind of like public masturbation. It's not actually doing anything, you know?
It's not. I mean, and it's important, you know, it's a good, you know,
it makes
community
you feel
building
good.
Exercise
it makes
is
you
how people find out about stuff.
Right.
But it has to be sort of cashed in with the stuff that's going to make a difference to the people who have the decision-making authority, right? And a lot of the times, like, you – I mean, it sounds – I did not believe this for a long time, but legislators really care disproportionately about constituent contact. Like I say, for, like, you know, really big stuff, it's not – I mean, I'm not going to, you know, make the claim that everyone's just voting their conscience every time. But it is the one thing that anyone can do, and, you know, and you should.
Do you ever think that'll switch? Like, 20 years from now, you'll hear on CNN, assuming it's not dead, that's like, this unpopular legislation is a trending topic at Twitter, and it's got legislators worried that their jobs are on the line. I mean, do you think they'll actually switch to, like, okay, we don't make phone calls, we'll send you a text maybe, and we don't write letters, for God's sake? Do you think they'll ever start paying attention to the digital stuff?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. I think they will. I mean, as time passes and that's how people, you know, communicate with each other, you know, sure. I mean, you know, they didn't used to probably care about faxes, you know, now they do. They unfortunately still care about faxes. They have fax machines. That's good stuff. But, you know, sure, it's going to be, you know, in the end, you know, legislators are, you know, they're human beings and they want to keep their jobs and they don't always have like a good sense of like what that's going to require. And so they're very, you know, they're very risk averse. And so when there's a lot of stuff like, you know, sort of frightening them, you know, they're going to do stuff about it. And when they, as they pay attention to stuff, like, I don't know.
You mentioned, I wanted to follow up with this and I forgot at the time, but you said that you did not want to comment on WikiLeaks. Is that because you have a complex view of the matter? Is it because the U.S. government is actively involved in some litigation in that regard or investigation?
Yeah, it's that. I mean, the thing is, like, I have many complicated thoughts on WikiLeaks, but, you know, the Justice Department is not messing around with these guys, and it's – even though I have sort of disclaimed up and down that my views are not the Justice Department's views, this is one of those really sensitive areas where I don't think I should say anything at all, because, you know, at the end of the day, I am still a lawyer who works at the Justice Department, and
gotcha.
Like I said, everyone's risk averse. Everyone likes to keep their job. I just don't want to be like the guy on the podcast talking about WikiLeaks when he shouldn't. I don't want to be that guy.
I think we just got lawyered out of some really juicy WikiLeaks commentary.
Maybe we'll take
especially don't want to talk about it because it's not a million years close to anything I have to do. I mean, like, sure. I really shouldn't be commenting because, you know, there are many Justice Department lawyers, I'm sure, who think about WikiLeaks as part of their job. I'm not even one of them. Mm-hmm. So I really shouldn't say what I'm talking. You shouldn't say anything because I don't even know what I'm talking about. So WikiLeaks is very interesting. I follow it with interest, and I'm sure we all will. So that's it.
Let me ask you a kind of a philosophical underpinning question.
Okay.
Do you believe the information should be free?
Well, you know, everyone knows, I think, that by now, the second half of that quotation, which is, it goes, information wants to be free. Information wants to be expensive. And the point is that, like, it's very easy to transmit and duplicate information, but information is also extremely valuable. So this sort of – out of this central tension kind of grows the sort of last 30 years of, you know, first world history. So, I mean, what does it mean for information to be free? I mean, I think that, you know – It's hard to sort of answer that question in the abstract. I mean, I believe in, you know, if information being free means a robust public domain, yeah, I believe in that. If information being free means, you know, a lot of people, sort of hobbyists, creating great stuff and giving it away for free because they're not trying to make money on it, they just want to make cool things, yeah, that sounds pretty good. You know, I wrote a bunch of, you know, I wrote, as we were discussing, I wrote 10,000 posts analyzing complicated scientific subject when I was, you know, in high school talking about Star Trek and Star Wars. So that was pretty good. I gave that away for free. If information being free means that, you know, artists can't make a living, that doesn't sound so good. If information being free means that, you know, a writer or an artist or whatever can't make enough money doing what they like doing to be able to do it full time, that doesn't sound so good because, I like reading the work of writers. I like looking at the work of artists. I like listening to the work of musicians. And I want those people to be able to do that as their job and make money from it all the time. So, and I don't think anyone really disagrees with either of those things. So, you know, it's complicated. And I think that the one thing that everybody should be able to agree on is, like, information about, you know, that – there's this big government initiative to release a lot of the information about government in sort of open formats that are easily, like, machine readable and stuff like that, to, you know, release the federal budget as a sort of parsable XML file so you can drill down and, like, create cool tools. Or, for example, when now Justice Kagan was nominated to the Supreme Court, there was a big release by the White House of all of her previous emails. She's been a White House counselor many years ago in the Clinton administration. They released a big dump of machine-readable email that she had written, as sort of, you know, just released to the public. And then the Sunlight Foundation, I'm pretty sure, created a website, which may still exist, called elenasinbox.com. Elena Kagan, Elena is her first name, called elenasinbox.com. And it was a searchable Gmail-style interface of all of her previous emails that had been, you know, freely released by the government. But it was so much more useful and interesting and readable, and you could do all this neat stuff with it, and you could go back and, like, read this stuff. It was really cool. And so if information being free means stuff like that, yeah, I'm definitely for that. And sort of the information about, you know, what the government is doing and the sort of way the government works, like, that stuff, you know, being out there, that's pretty good. So
Okay. All I know is that Shakespeare got to be paid, son.
Has to be paid.
That's where I'm like, I like pop culture and I want them to keep making of it. I think it's interesting. I kind of see it's going back to the patronage system because, you know, they keep talking about this growing disparity between the haves and haves not. And back in feudal and medieval and Renaissance times, a lot of times wealthy, you know, landowners and noblemen would sponsor artists for their own kind of vanity and self-glory. But lots of beautiful art was enjoyed by the public as a result. And I kind of wonder if we eventually, as like the billion and trillionaires, you know, get more and more and more of that, if they won't start like to compete amongst themselves, you know, they all got money. They're going to start to try to find the best and brightest artists and, you know, intellectual minds. And that's going to be the new kind of social currency.
It's possible, although I think that even more likely is that we will see artists and creative people of all stripes being able to sell their work directly to the end, like end appreciators of it. Like, so my mother, who, as you noted, is a professional novelist, she has been digitizing and putting her own back catalog on ebook stores like Kindle and Nook and all of that stuff, because she has the way the contracts work is you get your copyright and your stuff back after a certain amount of time. So she's got the copyright to her books again, and has been selling her back catalog stuff, and it's been making a ton of money.
I mean, bet
big paydays selling this stuff. Her own back catalog on Amazon directly to people. And it's no mystery as to why. You know, when you sell a book through Amazon, even though Amazon is a kind of a middleman, you get 70% of the sale price.
Right.
When you're an author selling, you know, your books through a publisher and in a physical bookstore, you're not getting anywhere close to 70%. I mean, try more like 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe 10%. It's
right.
Nothing. It's nothing.
Right.
It's, you know, it's the effect of all this stuff is it's never been a worse time to be a middleman. It's never been a better time to – I mean, you know, it's great stuff. You can write a book today. Anyone can write a book. The equipment to do so is amazingly cheap. All you need is a, you know, piece of shit laptop and you can write a book. And if that book is good, you can have an audience of hundreds of millions of people who can buy it. You don't need any infrastructure. You don't need anything. If you can write something that's good and get it out there, you can make yourself rich doing what you're great at. I mean, that's good stuff. I think there will be maybe some patronage in the future, that kind of thing. That, like what you're talking about, that sounds pretty good. But I also just think, you know, increasingly the sort of independent creator is going to be king, and that is very good.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's like – I think the patronage is more for higher cost of entry stuff, like, you know, making a Lord of the Rings trilogy, for example. Yeah. You know, you're not going to be independently making a $100 million movie, but, you know, George Soros might be a Tolkien fan and front you to money just because he thinks it's really cool to see something like that made. So
yeah. Well, I often wonder, like – so obviously the technology to have like you know, first run movies delivered directly into the home. Obviously that exists, right?
It's getting
and a
there,
lot of people
sure.
have, you know, pretty nice home theater setups.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, like, when are we going to get to the point where you can pay? I mean, obviously you're going to have to pay a lot. You're not going to be able to pay like the price of a movie ticket because they're going to want to protect revenues. But imagine you could pay like, let's say $100 to stream, you know, a first run movie onto your, you know, home theater, you know, your projection system. You invite 5, 6, 7 people over. It becomes cost effective. You don't have to go to the movie theater. You don't have to listen to a bunch of assholes eating really loudly next to you. You know, you don't have to go anywhere, and you enjoy this great movie, and the movie theater gets $100.
That's
you know,
exactly
the
way pay-per-view works now.
You know, $100. Or maybe it'd be more than that. I don't know. But I feel like we got to get there eventually.
That's exactly the way like pay-per-view boxing events and MMA fights work now. Nobody just spends $50 to $75 and watch it by themselves, invite all their buddies over. Everybody kicks in $5 on the six-pack, and there you go.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's I just feel like that's got to be, you know, we're going to see experiments with that. I mean, I don't know who's going to do it first, but the, you know, the technology already exists. It's just a matter of somebody who has the sort of commercial will to do so. It'd be very exciting.
Absolutely. We were talking earlier about some of the more effective ways to combat any negative trends we see. And that kind of leads us into the organizations that do that. What is the importance of, say, organizations like the EFF? And is it worthwhile to donate to their causes, to give them money to fight these battles for us?
Well, I think so. So I should say there's a little bit of a, you know, I have some skin in this game because, you know, there are EFF lawyers who are friends of mine and, you know, software Freedom Foundation guys who are, you know, these people are my friends. And so I'm obviously biased. But long before that was true, I did give money regularly to the EFF every month. I think I gave them $20 for a long time. And it is worthwhile because the thing is, like, they are doing tremendous work on and they really make the money count. These are very, very smart guys and girls who are – they're very, very smart. I mean the friends I have that are doing this kind of work are like my smart friends. They are not – you know, so they've got the best folks and those folks are working for way less than they could make at a private law firm, and they are doing, you know, top quality stuff. So is it worth it? Yeah, like, hell yeah, it's worth it. I mean, and these are good organizations. I really feel like they put the money to good use. And you know, they get stuff for people that, you know, you may never even know about. So, for example, let me give you an example. The EFF started litigating this series of cases about cell phone tracking where – basically, you know, the government investigator would want to know about your whereabouts, since they'd get an order from a court that would allow them to track your cell phone using, like, you know, cell tower positioning, which is pretty accurate. They were getting this without actually showing probable cause that you had committed a crime or anything like that. They just kind of wanted to know. And the EFF started to get involved in these cases and, you know, quite successfully in many cases and actually challenged the ability of the government to do this. Now, you know, it was the Justice Department that was doing this, but I'm already on record because I wrote my student note about this thinking that we probably need probable cause for that. So nothing new here. But you've probably never heard of this before, but they're doing a great job. They go in there. It's a sort of like they get right in at the beginning and they make, you know, very effective use of that money, and they, you know, win, you know, important privacy rights for a lot of people. So these are good groups. These are good groups. And if you're looking for an effective way to use your charitable dollar, boy, you could do a lot worse.
One follow-up question I had along the lines of the Amazon cloud services and the organizations that fight these sort of legal battles. What do you see the role of sort of these more altruistic, I guess, businesses that are coming up that are like the Amazons and the Googles? And I know they're still in it for the profit, obviously, their business. But some of their mission statements seem to be more in line with what the consumer would want. Do you see any role of business in fighting the legal trends alongside the EFF and other organizations that might be coming up in the future?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, remember the case that Aaron was talking about, you know, the time shifting case was a case between, you know, a movie theater and a movie studio and Sony. Because Sony had an interest in being able to sell you a device that time shifted this thing. And so they had an incentive to sort of stick up for the rights of consumers. And they did so very successfully. So, I would encourage people not to think about the world in like sort of like Manichean, like business versus consumer terms. Like, it's not quite that simple. Like, it's really about different business models competing to survive. So, like, right now, I like to use this example where it's like, you know, when the refrigerator was invented, a lot of milkmen went out of business because all of a sudden you didn't need milk delivered to you every single day because you could just refrigerate it for a week.
Sure.
And so, like, the businessman who sort of made his living running the milkman company, like, his business model didn't make sense anymore. And all of a sudden, a different guy's business model, the refrigerator salesman, you know, his business model suddenly made a lot more sense. Well, it's the same thing now. It's a competition between old and new business models. So you've got, you know, on the one hand, you know, the way Amazon makes its money is by giving you, you know, access to all of your music sort of anywhere you want to have it and selling it to you at a very low price, better than so, you know, versus, you know, the music industry traditionally made their money by sort of selling you the same song over and over again. First, you buy it on tape, you buy it on vinyl, you buy it on CD, then you buy a digital download. And so, you know, it's just a competition between these two business models. And so, like, yeah, there's a big role for businesses to sort of fight these things. And, you know, good thing.
Okay, so I want to ask one more follow-up question to just kind of get to the root of how you feel specifically about altruism in business. Because I've been following the startup scene on places like Hacker News and other sites for a long time now, and it seems like the trend in small business, in these startups, has been to provide the customer with a valuable service that enables them to do something better or easier, and it, they're not so much concerned about making tons of money. A lot of them want to help consumers, and so you've got big companies like Amazon and Google doing that. So do you feel that that is something that's valid, something that's going to continue? And this may be a little bit out of your field of expertise, but I was just wondering your opinion.
No, I think it will. I mean, I think that, you know, there are a lot of things that motivate people in life, and it's not just money. I mean, people want to get rich, and that's good because, you know, a good way to get rich is by making something that a lot of people like. Uh-huh. But, you know, they also want to be sort of like thought well of by their peers, and within this sort of world of, you know, especially the sort of startup world, especially in the sort of like pockets where it's most concentrated, it's a very tight-knit community, and like being thought of as like an asshole who's sort of like against the rights of the user will like cost you friends, and like you're not going to get invited to the cool parties anymore, and like nobody wants that, right? Yeah, I think there's a. I think that the, you know, I wouldn't even necessarily call it altruism. I'd call it a different way of, you know, people are motivated by self-interest for a lot of different reasons, and sort of being thought of as the kind of guy who or girl who does the right thing and sort of sticks up for the right people and is isn't evil. Yeah, I mean, how much you know distance did Sergey and Larry get out of the "don't be evil" thing? I mean, it's, you know, widely satirized, but you know they.
Sure.
They got a lot of cred for that, right? I mean, even if it isn't exactly true anymore, you know, the whole "don't be evil" thing is such a contrast. So, I think I agree with you.
Let's switch our gears a little bit to the executive side of the government branch. What's your opinion of this? What I'm going to say, bullshit, going up in a country where police officers and public officials are persecuting and prosecuting individuals for shooting pictures and film of them doing their duty?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, it's this is I agree. I don't think this is good. I mean, I think that it's too bad because for one, I think everybody should be able to agree that having a record of how our public officials go about their duties is good, not just for the public, but actually for the officials. I mean, you know, if every police officer's every move were recorded, what we would discover is that actually most of them are very decent, conscientious people who are working hard to do the right thing, and we would be able to identify the ones who aren't very rapidly.
Sure.
Because the thing is, there's nothing that's worse for a decent police officer than a bad apple who makes everyone look terrible. And so, and that's who's driving this stuff, is the bad apples, the sort of 0.1% of guys who cause 99% of the problems and don't want any accountability. Whereas the, you know, most police officers really are just, you know, trying to do the right thing. And of course, recording those guys would show nothing exceptional at all. So I agree. I think it's very disturbing, the idea that there'd be something wrong with making a record of, you know, a public official discharging their duties in public. I mean, there should be no objection to that at all. Mm-hmm. But so
Speaking of bad apples, the next question is on police brutality. And where do you feel that force or excessive force or whatever fits in with law enforcement? And could we actually, in a truly transparent society, completely eliminate police brutality? And do we want to eliminate police brutality?
Because we want to brutalize criminals, right?
I mean, personally, I want to brutalize criminals, but...
Right, like Sideshow Bob had it right. We every once in a while need these cold-hearted guys to lower taxes, brutalize criminals, and rule us like a king. They can't do that if they can't beat us up and rough us up every once in a while.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a tricky subject because... It's very hard, I think, for most people to understand, including me, what it's actually like to sort of be a police officer kind of on the job, to know that, like, you know, a badge is not a magic shield, right? Police officers get killed and get hurt all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's perfectly understandable that in the heat of the moment, things are done that upon colder reflection don't look like such a good idea. I'm not saying that stuff's okay, but I have a lot more sympathy for that than I do this sort of, I mean, there are instances of sort of what I would think of as true brutality where, you know, you've got an officer who's like, you know, got somebody handcuffed on the ground or something and is roughing them up. That's not okay.
And, don't tase me, bro.
That absolutely, you know, and, you know, police departments are, I think sort of should be given some credit when they take action against folks like that. 'Cause it really is, you know, in police departments everywhere, you know, 99% of the problems are caused by 1% to 2% of the officers. It's just there are certain people who are just bad apples, and most police officers are really just trying to do their job. But, you know, so, yeah, I mean, I'm sensitive to that. I mean, you know, it's tough. You know, you knock on a door of a, you know, some place you think is a drug warren at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you hear a loud noise, like, boy, shit, that'd startle me too. Mm-hmm. And I might do something that upon considered reflection had been hasty. But we got to distinguish that between, you know, instances of just, you know, masochism and cruelty. So.
Yeah, and I think we have to factor in that they are putting their lives on the line every day. And when you step into that house where the loud noise goes off, you don't know what that is. It's possible that's a gunshot. It's possible that your life is in danger, so you're going to take actions to rectify that. So I could definitely see giving a little leeway on that, yeah.
I certainly understand it, at least. Even if I think, like, look, you know, if you violate people's rights, there have to be remedies.
Sure.
But we should just, you know, we should always just try to remember how we might act in the same circumstances. And, you know, even if it doesn't make stuff right, it at least, I don't know, it can help make it more comprehensible.
Right. Talk about you mentioned that I think you called the doctrine a doctrine of copyright maximalism.
Maximalism, yeah.
What are your thoughts? This is from Mad Brew as well, one of our listeners. What are your thoughts on the ability, and we've talked about this a lot, for the little guy to be able to defend himself in a case of fair use or even wildly off-base lawsuits without major funding? It seems like corporations with deep pockets can pretty much bulldoze anyone they want. What can a little guy do? Represent himself? And he lists a couple of case laws. One that was particularly seemed ridiculous was Monster Energy Drink successfully getting this brewery, Rock Art Brewery, to not sell a beverage called the Vermonster, which was a play on the state Vermont, not Monster Energy Drink. And so what – I mean, that does seem like it's very oppressive if you are in the right, but you can't stand up for yourself because you can't afford the law to defend yourself.
Yeah, or just you know, another example of this is just this week, this guy Andy Bayo, or Bayo, or I don't know how you say his name, he released this chiptune album some time ago called Kind of Bloop, which was a chiptune version of Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, which he funded through Kickstarter, and it was very cool. And the cover of it was a pixel art version that was meticulously hand created. A pixel art version of the actual album cover of Kind of Blue. And it looks great. And you can find it online. It looks good. And I bought it at the time. I'm glad I did. Well, the photographer who had taken that picture sued this guy just recently. And this guy, I mean, he said, look, I have no doubt that my pixel art version of the album cover constitutes fair use. There's just no doubt in my mind. I know I'm right. But the litigation to fight this would be more expensive than I can afford. So he settled it, and not for nothing either. He settled for $32,000.
Which probably bit out a lot of the Kickstarter funds.
Yeah, that's not nothing. And also agreed to stop using it as the cover, as the album cover for Kind of Blue. So, I mean, one thing I would say is, you know, if you have $5, go buy Andy Bio's chiptune album Kind of Blue, because you could really use the money. But the reality, I mean, it's unfortunate, but the reality is in the you know, the American legal system is expensive. Litigation is very expensive and really cannot be done by amateurs. I would do not freelance this stuff, because if you lose, you are very screwed. It can't be done by amateurs, and it's expensive, and you know, each side pays their own costs. So even if you win, it's not like you, except in some, you know, very particular and rare circumstances, it's not like you get attorney's fees from the loser just for having won. So even a victory may be more than you can afford. So unfortunately, it does create the possibility of a lot of sort of bullying, and we see that. It's the same thing that just happened to all those Apple developers, like iPhone developers, who are getting sort of pushed around by a patent troll. You know, what can you really do? I mean, you can fight it, but it's going to be more expensive than just sort of giving in. And, you know, it's terrible, but it's the way the system is. So what can you do? Unfortunately, the answer is what can a little guy do is, you know, nothing.
Wow. This has actually been more depressing than I thought.
Okay. Then I just have one more question for you. Is it not true that in high school your name was actually the Vermonster?
That is correct. I was interdicted by some time traveling trademark lawyers, and that is why I decided to go into law, so that I could go back and avenge myself.
Right the wrong.